Welcome to Motivation to Write, the mini version of the podcast where I share one writing tip a week on the art of writing. This week, it's all about food. This episode was inspired by my recent interview with vegan chef Tommy Macanjula. She has a magnificent story about her journey from a blogger to author. And the name of that episode is called It All Started with a Blog. I highly suggest you give it a listen. But after having talked with her, I thought, how is it that writers are able to capture the essence of food and write about food in such a way that my mouth waters and I want to read those passages over and over and over? How do they do that? So let's take a look and see if we can figure out. So my first example is from Chicago poet Angela Jackson. She was actually named Illinois Poet Laureate last year. This poem is called Grits, and I'm going to read it. All night, she watched the pot, cooked her grits thick for hours, not the quick kind, till grains disappear into smooth with a slick coat on top. Hot enough for a man to wear, she said, on both his faces. Woo! You can sense the tension underneath this essay. It is boiling underneath this essay. Okay. Now, I actually got this poem from an essay by Cynthia R. Greenlee called A Real Hot Mess, How Grits Got Weaponized Against Cheating Men. So if you want an interesting read, definitely check out that essay. But let's get back to the grits. How is it? Because I can see this bowl of steamy hot grits in front of me and I can smell them and I can taste them. How did she do that? I think what it is she narrows in on one essential element that anyone who has ever enjoyed a bowl of steamy grits will instantly recognize. And that is the slick coat on top. And because you instantly recognize this, you can picture it in your head vividly. And then when you picture it in your head, you can taste it. You can smell it, right? So it's that narrowing in on that one essential recognizable element, because it's so simple, that description, that's the slick coat on top, that its vitality to the poem, it may elude you. But if you delete that line or that description, the grits change from delicious, hot, and dangerous to just dangerous, right? So narrowing in on an essential element of the food. Now let's look at another example. This is from one of my favorite childhood books, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory by Roald Dahl. And if you've ever read that book, even if you haven't read the book, if you've seen any of the films, you know that this story is full of all kinds of deliciousness, chocolate and candy and yummy things. But I want us to look at how Dahl describes the bland meals that the Bucketts eat, the Bucket family, that's Charlie's family, right? Okay, here's the passage. The only meals they could afford were bread and margarine for breakfast, boiled potatoes and cabbage for lunch, and cabbage soup for supper. Talk about uninspired. Yet, even though this is uninspired, I can taste and smell these meals. I can taste the blandness of these meals. Now, how does he do that? Dahl uses specific nouns connotating flavorlessness and poverty. Margarine, we think of margarine as the cheaper, fake version of butter, right? Boiled potatoes, for some reason, whenever I think of like stories I've read where there's like a large family with lots of kids, or even old films where there's large family, lots of kids, and they don't have a lot of money, they seem to always be boiling potatoes, right? I think of the Irish famine when I think of boiled potatoes. And then cabbage, cabbage is just blah, right? So he uses these specific nouns that connotate specific feelings, emotions, and he stays away from adjectives to embellish any of these words. Like he doesn't say wheat bread or soft bread. He doesn't say crunchy cabbage. Just he keeps everything plain, and the plain descriptions underscore the bland flavors, right? Now I want you to contrast Dahl's bland meals with this mouth-watering spread described in this New Yorker article called Bar Omar. It's by Becky Cooper, and it's from the Tables for Two section of the New Yorker. Here we go. But the tagine, lamb, chicken, or kefta, is the showstopper. Portioned for two, it arrives in a tall clay vessel clutched between napkins. The waiter pauses for dramatic effect before rolling off the lid, letting steam billow out. If you ordered the lamb, swollen prunes, fat apricots, and egg-shaped potatoes hug two giant shanks sunk in a steel bubbling broth. The prunes collapse into a sweet, jammy mess the second they're touched. Shovel some of the fruit over meat, pulled clean from the bone, add slivered almonds for crunch, and it's the perfect bite. Ending your meal with dessert is a must, and the creme brulee is irreproachably classic. Shatter the shell of blistered sugar into pieces that look like stained glass and try not to smile. Doesn't that make your mouth water? I mean, look, I'm a vegetarian, okay? Yet my mouth waters every time I read this description. Every time I read this description. So how does she do this? Well, first of all, I love how she illustrates the show that this meal puts on, because she does say it's a showstopper, right? She begins with its stately entrance in this tall vessel clutched between two napkins. It's like a king arriving in a palanquin. And the waiter, and as the waiter removes the lid, steam billows out. It is very dramatic. But if we look at specifically the food, right? How does she describe food? It's the detail that makes me drool. The detail with which Cooper describes the food. Unlike Dahl's lack of adjectives to highlight the tastelessness of the meals of the Bucket family, Cooper chooses adjectives capturing, like Jackson, Angela Jackson did in her poem, capturing the essential elements of each food item. Swollen prunes, fat apricots, and egg-shaped potatoes. I mean, isn't swollen just like the perfect adjective? That just really captures the essence of prunes, because they do look swollen. Apricots do look fat, and potatoes are shaped like eggs. So those help to paint very vivid images in your head. And if you can clearly see the food, it's just automatically you start tasting it and you start smelling it, right? She uses verbs wonderfully for effect, right? The prunes, the apricots, and the potatoes hug the meat. The prunes collapse into a sweet mess. And she implores the reader to shovel the fruit over the lamb before taking a bite. And we cannot forget about dessert. That's my favorite part of any meal is dessert. Cooper, again, she uses adjectives, this adjective in particular, blistered, to highlight the most recognizable feature of creme brulee, that burnt sugar on top, right? She tells us to shatter, another verb, shatter the shell, comparing its brokenness to, quote, pieces of stained glass. That's a very vivid simile. She's using a simile there. So what are the takeaways here? What are the takeaways? Well, takeaway number one is, if you want to get your readers' mouths watering, highlight a food's essential element everyone will recognize, because readers love familiarity. It helps them paint a clear image in their heads, and it helps them feel like they can relate to your story. Use verbs to bring food to life. Illustrating food moving, for example, like meat falling from the bone, evokes delicious imagery. And lastly, use precise adjectives and nouns to convey the mood, emotion, and flavor of food. It's one thing to say Mary eats potato chips, but is she eating thin, plain chips, thick, ruffled chips, or organic chips? Does it matter? Because if it matters, it might matter, because it might suggest something about her character trait she has, or it might foreshadow an event, right? So if it does matter, then be specific. Be specific. I had such a great time writing this piece and recording this piece. I have a list of works cited that you can check out and also suggested readings. And try writing about one of your favorite meals, like right now, and see how you can narrow in on that one essential element and use nouns and verbs. That's my timer, I time myself, to really bring the food to life. Thank you so much for tuning in to this episode of Motivation to Write. And I will see you next time. But before I go, I just thought you can follow me on Facebook and Instagram at Motivation to Write, Twitter at Ebony Haywood, and you can subscribe to my weekly newsletter at zazo.com. Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.